Well, good morning, everybody. And it was fun to talk at breakfast, huh? You really appreciate talking a lot when you don't do it for a while. And it does feel like we have been together a long time. And in some way, I think somebody said at the beginning that being together in silence, going through all these things side by side, you know, kind of wordlessly together, you really do bond with people, and it's powerful. So there's a sense in which this has become, in a few short days, a very real community, which in a few minutes will disperse, never to reassemble again in quite the same way, which is very sad and typical. That's how life goes, right? So one appreciates it while we can, and for all the ways it touches us. So I think that at this point I really don't need to say so much because it's pretty clear, I think. I hope, anyway, we've made clear in the things that so many of us have said what we're trying to do here, how we're going about doing it, and why we think it's important. I think this is all clear now. And for those of us who have been putting the retreat together and trying to lead it, for us, it's very clear that the practice of meditation in the way that we've been doing it, this very simple practice, and the extending of the mindfulness from the meditation into our daily lives, we have all found this to be a really powerful way to really live a different life, really reframe one's life, change the way that we respond to the world, and slowly by slowly over time, maybe without even realizing it's happening, shift our basic attitudes about life and our vision of who we think we are, and what we think the world is, and most importantly for us, what it means to do the work that we're doing. When I said to Frank yesterday, why don't you stop being a lawyer and become a spiritual practitioner, pretend you're a lawyer when you go to work every day, this was not a joke. I was completely serious. That's what I'm talking about. I mean, that's one way of saying it. Another way of saying it is to really be a lawyer. That's the way Charlie was talking about it yesterday. You know, return to the roots of what it really means to be a lawyer and stop doing this crazy idea in our world of what the world tells us it means to be a lawyer. And use everything that happens in that process to learn from. And the meditation practice, as we've been saying, is really, really simple. It's not complicated, and anyone is capable of it. Sit down, breathe, pay attention. Pretty much that's it. Sit down, breathe, pay attention. There are a million possible variations, and if you go on websites and search out meditation instructions, you'll find lots and lots and lots of them. But in the end, they're all variations on sit down, breathe, pay attention. And you know, one can make good use of many variations for specific purposes to refresh your practice in various ways. But in the end, it's really radically simple. So, you could view this weekend as a powerful, if you want to, you know, it could be for you, a powerful sort of initiation where you really got the hang of this and really got the inspiration for it. And you can do it. You can continue the practice. So let me tell you very briefly a few things, how you could actually do that in a very practical way. What would it mean? Or what are the options for continuing the practice? So the first thing is, you could sit every day for 15, 20 minutes, 30 minutes. Doesn't have to be a long time. I think the best thing to do is, the way I do it is, I get up, I put water on my face, I'm sitting. In other words, I pee. Before I think about my day and have entertained the thought that I don't really have time today to meditate, before I have a chance to do that, I'm already sitting there. That's the key. If you have your coffee, if you read your paper, you've made it much more difficult to get to the cushion. Just that's practical. So the way to do this, if you want to do it, is to do it immediately, before any of that. If you have to get up a little earlier, the time is well worth it. So you can sit every day. You can take the weekends off. You can take some days off. But basically, sitting every day. And this is what Charlie was saying he does. He sits every day, and he goes to an annual retreat. And I think this is important, to go to an annual retreat, one of the lawyer retreats, a longer silent retreat at some point you probably would want to do. There are lots of long retreats available. The Insight Meditation Society, which has a branch in New York City, in Boston, and in California, has a lot of great retreats. I do retreats. Many other people do retreats. You can find a retreat that's suitable for you. And think about, if you want to really make this an ongoing practice for yourself, to do a retreat every year, to kind of strengthen and give you fresh energy for the practice. So that's one thing. Sitting practice every day, one retreat a year. And then, as Kathleen said, I think last night, it really makes a big difference that you have some input to begin to reflect on your framework and your point of view. And we've been giving you a lot of input, you know, this weekend. And all the things, all the talks will be available through the Contemplative Mind and Society website, and I'll probably put them on the Everyday Zen website. There are countless books, Dharma books, more than you can ever possibly read. There are many, many websites with audio files of Dharma talks, meditation instructions. The meditation instructions that I gave this weekend will also be on the Everyday Zen website. And I think there's actually like a lawyer's section on that website with all the talks that I've given in previous retreats and various meditation instructions. So in other words, there's a lot of places that you can go to have input. And the idea of having some regular input, food for thought, so that you can engage and challenge your usual viewpoint, which always reasserts itself, have you noticed? Always comes back. And it will. So you have to engage it and think about it and have some input to help you do that. Fourth, some support, some ongoing support. Later on, Doug's going to talk about how you could have a buddy and work with a buddy, somebody that you would, and it's actually very doable and very practical. You make connection with one person. You make an agreement that you'll have a phone call, whatever it is, once a week, twice a month, once a month. There's a structure for the phone call, so it's not just a chat. You have a way of, you know, structuring it, which I think the handout gives some suggestions for that, but you can do it your own way, but structure it somehow. And that call will be very supportive. It'll be like these groups that we've had. It's so wonderful to have a chance to talk about what's going on with you and always reference, as Charlie always reminds us, and what does the practice have to do with this? How can the practice engage this? That kind of a conversation with a colleague can be invaluable for support. You know you're not alone in this. So if you could do that, and as far as the daily sitting, So that's one trick, is do it before you get involved in anything else. But another trick is, don't make a resolution that starting on Monday, you're going to sit every day for the rest of your life. Don't do that to yourself. Because I'll tell you what will happen. You'll miss a day, and you'll say, damn, I guess I really can't do this. And you'll miss another day, and you'll say, oh boy, I'm losing it. And then you'll miss a third day, and you'll say, that's it, I guess I can't do this. What a dream. It would have been nice, but I can't do it. So instead, say, I'm going to do my best to try this for 3 months or 1 month. Something reasonable, not the rest of your life. 1 month, 2 months, 3 months. And after that period of time, stop doing it. I think it would be good to stop doing it for a week or two. And then reflect, was that worthwhile? Was that worth my time? Did it make a difference? And if it did, another 3 months. You may come to the place where you say, I want to do this. But don't do that to yourself initially, because I think it'll be unsuccessful. In other words, you see what I'm getting at. You have to be, you know, the most incalcitrant person to work with is yourself. And you really have to be clever dealing with yourself, because you're so tricky, you know. You'll do yourself in every time, you know. Yeah, we all do. We all do. So you really have to take yourself in hand, you know, and say, okay, now, I know who this person is, and I know how to handle her. So these simple things, sitting every day, more or less, going to retreat once a year, and maybe it's not this year, maybe this is your retreat for the year, and a year from now you'll consider, you know, a retreat. Sitting every day, an annual retreat, some input, some support, tapes, books, and a buddy or some other means of support for your practice. Maybe you have a local group you could attend. Go to that group. Maybe you're going to be able to go to what Robert's doing at the Bar Association. That would be a valuable thing. Maybe you'll find other ways of support, but some way, you need support. Okay, in addition to all this, I'm going to suggest some other practices that you can use to extend this into your daily life. And many of them have already been suggested, and there could be many more, but I just made a little list this morning. Susan's practice of signs and screensavers. You know, breathe, pay attention, come back to myself, put in strategic places around your house or office. It actually helps. They get invisible after a while, and take them away and put new ones up. Slogans, you know, to keep you going. That's one. Number two, the practice that Valerie mentioned, the email practice. Every time you write an email, and you write plenty of them, when you finish the email, stop, come back to yourself, visualize or have a feeling for the person who's going to receive the email. Even if you've never seen the person, think about who they may be. Just for a moment, reread the email, make any changes that now seem important, press the send button. This is a huge practice. It'll make a big difference. The third practice that we suggested earlier, at the end of every day, instead of rushing off with your briefcase, stuff falling out of it, you know, sit down at your desk and review the day. In other words, I don't mean intentionally thinking about this and that or trying to solve problems, but just being with what happened today. I'm going to be with, for a moment, what happened today. What I felt, who I saw, what was that? What happened today? You know, what did I go through today? What did it feel like? Just be there with what it felt like, with whatever arises, and just notice what arises. 5 minutes, 10 minutes at the most. Make a big difference. And this can be a daily practice. You'll go home a different person. Very important. Fourth, during the day, anytime you feel like it, anytime you think of it, stop what you're doing and take 3 conscious breaths. Just breathe in and out 3 times. Powerful practice, and it shifts things suddenly. this awareness stuff is very subtle. I mean, there's almost nothing to it, and yet the whole world shifts. And you'll see, take three breaths anytime, particularly if you find yourself distraught and upset. That's a particularly good time. You won't think of it or you won't want to do it, but if you train yourself to do it, you'll see how just those three breaths will slightly shift the situation enough so that things will be different and there'll be new possibilities. Number five, phone meditation. The phone rings, if the phone rings. I don't, nowadays, who knows if the phone rings or plays a little song or whatever it does. And there's some unconscious reaction that happens to us when the phone rings. It's different for different people. But shift that to make a conscious reaction. Listen, make, in other words, make the sound of the phone the call to meditation. Train yourself to condition yourself to that way. And then when you reach for the phone, again, like with the email, take a breath and think about that there's going to be a person, a human being at the other end of this line that you're going to have a precious interaction with. No matter who it is or what they're calling for, that's the potential in every phone call. Give yourself a moment to think of that and pick up the phone and answer the phone. You have time. It just takes about one ring of the phone to do this. Sixth, walking meditation. We were practicing walking meditation. The secret is you can always practice walking meditation. You don't need to walk real slow. Just walk a little bit, maybe more slowly than you are used to walking. And pay attention to walking. Don't think that the time of walking from one place to another is this throwaway time where you're just rushing to get there and you're not really there walking. Be there walking. From your car or from the subway to the office. That's a meditation walk. From your desk to the toilet, to the bathroom. That's a meditation walk. Going to the bathroom. What a break that is. How nice. You know? It's meditation. Make that conscious. Bring yourself to yourself in those moments. And walking meditation is really beautiful and supportive. And I do it all the time. And it's wonderful. Seventh, Mercedes' suggestion of when you eat, eat. Just pay attention to eating. You're eating anyway. You don't need to do all those other things. Try that. We've been doing that here. Eating in silence. Try eating quietly in silence with awareness. And last, number eight, we haven't done this here, but we have used it in our other programs. Journaling. Just spontaneous journaling. That's a great way to find out what you're feeling. Process your what's going on with. There's so much going on in your work. And you're taking it all in and you don't have a chance to process it. And that's a lot of what we're talking about here is how to process that, all that's happening. So journaling is really a good one. So it's been great for me to, I always learn so much and I'm so moved by the things that I hear in these retreats. That's why I enjoy hearing what and seeing, you know, what you're experiencing, and I'm always moved by this work, which basically is all about taking on the most intractable human problems. You know, to do the work you're doing is you're putting yourself in the middle. I mean, because you could do something, you know, like me, you know, I don't really take on intractable human problems. I'm meditating, I'm enjoying myself, I'm relaxing, you know. But you actually have chosen, you probably didn't know what you were doing or you never would have chosen it probably. But you have chosen to put yourself right in the middle of the most intractable human problems. And somebody's got to do that. And so it's a tremendously noble thing and I really admire the work you're doing, and I feel actually very happy that in some small way I can come here and hopefully contribute something to what you're doing, because I admire it so much. I really do, and you know, and I've heard enough to know how hard it is to do it. And so we really need ways to make it doable and easier, and even, as John was saying, joyful. That was just kind of an astonishing statement, you know, but he meant it. So we know it's possible. I mean, I wouldn't blame you a bit if you didn't believe me. I wouldn't. But you can believe John. No, because John's doing it. So I really feel grateful that I can participate and move by what you do. The law is an ancient, noble profession, you know. And I like Charlie's idea of, you know, wise counsel. The law is a place where we would expect wisdom to arise. And what a great thing to reframe that for ourselves, as he suggested, to re-envision this ancient profession. And I'm serious, to conceive of lawyering in and of itself as a spiritual path. What could be a more poignant spiritual path than putting yourself in the middle of the most intractable human problems and trying to find their wisdom? So if you could begin to conceive of yourself as doing that in the law, this would be a beautiful thing. And it's hard, but it's definitely possible. And I think that's what we're trying to do, that we're trying to really foster a spirit in the law and a movement within the law. I guess we call it contemplative lawyering or whatever we call it, but it's based on this meditation practice. But more than the meditation practice per se, the meditation practice as fostering a spirit of wisdom in the law and in working with human problems. So there's a noble sense in this. In other words, on one hand, if it works for you, do this for yourself to make your life livable and doable and happy, but also do it for, you know, my son who's starting to be a lawyer just this year, and for the youngest of us, and for the people who are now in the eighth grade or in high school who are going to become lawyers, so that the profession becomes more humane and has something more to offer to people. So in other words, there's more than just yourself that at stake here. If we can create a sense that this is possible and that there are people doing it and there are institutions and retreats and events in the future that support it, this is a great thing. And Contemplative Mind and Society as an organization is supporting this. So support them to do it. And think of yourself as, you know, you are in this profession. Whatever economic benefits you have come from the profession. Think about supporting the profession and making it better as something that you're offering. I think that's important. So I want to thank all of you and for coming and for bringing, you know, the ways that people express themselves so honestly, you know, and truly, is really extraordinary, and I really appreciate that. And I especially want to thank the people who I worked with in this retreat, Sophia for supporting us so well and arranging for me the world's most expensive transportation, getting me to and from the airport, which I'm going to do before I'm going to have to leave before the morning session is over. I'll walk out and say goodbye after I'm done with my speaking. And Doug for doing a huge amount of work to set all this up. And thank you, Doug. And didn't he do a fantastic... This is the first time he's done... This is the first time he's done facilitation. The first time he's facilitated the groups and run the groups, and he did a great job, I thought. Did you? I mean, we had great conversations, and you know that it would have been possible for us not to have great conversations. You really need somebody to kind of get that going, you know. And Susan for her passion for this work and her talk and her spirit, you know, it's great. And especially to Charlie for all that he brought to this retreat. But actually, what Charlie brought to this retreat is the smallest part of it. Because Charlie has been fostering and supporting this work for many, many, many years. He was at one time with the Cummings Foundation that originally funded the Contemplative Mind and Society, so in a way it's his dream. And I don't know if Charlie says so, but Charlie comes from a lawyer family, so knows from an early age the pain of the profession. And really has devoted, I think, as far as I can understand Charlie, he's devoted his life, actually, his whole life, to this profession and making it better. So it's a long time. So I really appreciate that. And in his book is really kind of like the fruit of all of that. So I hope you'll enjoy his book. Okay, now the questions. Yes. Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, I always say that, except when I forget. yes, that's right. When I talk to people about establishing a daily meditation practice, and I understand how hard it is to do that, I always say, it starts the night before. That's when the morning practice starts. It starts the night before. Before you go to bed, as you're falling asleep, You say to yourself, tomorrow morning, I'm going to get up and I'm going to meditate first thing. You say that to yourself. And then you say to yourself, really? Is that really true? You should ask yourself that question. Is that really true? And then you should answer sincerely. And if the answer is, no, it's actually not true. I said that, but it's not really true. Then save yourself the trouble and the guilt and just don't even, so turn off the alarm. Don't worry about getting up. But if the answer is, yes, it's actually true, I'm actually going to do this, then when you go to sleep, you will know that you're going to do this. And when the alarm goes off, you will get up and you will do it. But it helps that, you know, because there's a lot of unconscious stuff going on, you know, about around this. For instance, you don't really deserve to be happier. I think a lot of that, this is a very commonplace thought. You know, you don't really deserve to be happier. So you don't think that thought. It's just that when the alarm goes off, you don't get up. And then you can tell yourself that you're not really serious about this, and then so on and so forth. And that really comes out of the deep-seated thought that someone kind of encouraged you to have, that you don't deserve to be happy. So that's why if you do this before you go to bed at night, it really helps. Yeah. Yes, please. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. What a great idea. That is a great idea. Because, of course, a lot of great things happen every day, but we're so burdened with our stuff that we actually don't notice. And that would help you to notice. Yeah. Yeah. Well, let me see if I can read these questions and try to say something about them. These may not be your questions anymore. They're probably not. You wrote the question and you forgot about it. So that's one thing. The other thing is the idea that I'm going to answer everybody's questions, of course, is an absurdity. But so what? I don't have the answers to all these questions. But so the first one is a beautiful question. Please instruct on how to meditate. Well, hopefully I don't have to answer that. Right? We did instruct on how to meditate. I think some additional instruction on meditation would be helpful, particularly on breathing and any gestures or acts to begin and end with. So I think I hope we did the meditation and we talked about breathing, but this part about gestures or acts to begin and end with, we haven't said much about. And you've noticed that some people go like this at the end of the sitting, and this is customary in a lot of Buddhist and yoga meditation places. So if you go to those places, you may find that. And it's a nice thing to do if you feel comfortable with it. Obviously, it's not a necessity. Some people like to have a space in their house for sitting, where they might have a candle or something, you know, and it's maybe one of these slogans that Susan is talking about could be on at that place. And it's nice to keep that place clean and sacred for your sitting. If you go to the Vipassana centers, there's not much ritual. I think people do bow after the sitting there, like that. If you go to a Zen place or a Tibetan Buddhist place, there's often more ritual. I think in Shambhala there's not much ritual, right? Or is there some? Some, yeah. So don't be surprised if you go to a place where you do see ritual. We haven't used any ritual here. And the ritual can be very supportive for the practice if you want to do it. This one says more instruction on meditation. These were all early on, you know. Correcting posture. I would feel more comfortable if I knew I was doing it correctly. So there's a lot said in that statement. And this just sort of speaks to the fact that we're so worried about doing things correctly. It can really, so don't worry so much about, this is not a science, it's really an art. And there isn't like, if you just do it this way, you're doing it right and these good results will come. And if you do it this way, a little bit off, then it won't work right. And it's really not like that. And so I think that what this tells us is that we have that in us, this worry about doing things correctly. And maybe we can soften around that. Two questions. One, how many minutes a day should one meditate, given constraints of busier lawyer's life, to feel benefits of mindfulness? So we just talked about that. You mentioned in your talk this morning that meditation is just one component of a balanced life. Just interested, what do you see as the other major categories? Well, you can fill in your own. There's so many. We have to take care of our bodies. To eat right, that takes time. We have to exercise, very important to exercise. Clean the body and the clothing that goes on the body, very big job. The body is a huge job. Lots to do there to take care of ourselves. If in case you should happen to have any human relationships, this also takes some effort. You have to, you know, talk to people and listen to people and be concerned about them sincerely, and that takes a lot of time. Just in case you have intelligence and a mind, you have to read some and think some and, you know, get some input and take care of your intellectual life so that, and not only for your profession, but also recreationally. You should read a poem now and then. You should read something besides the newspaper. Reading books is very important for us. And all of the things I was saying before about support for your practice and input for your practice. Taking care of your dog, yeah. Well, that goes under the category of human relationships. So actually, when you think about it, there's a lot involved in taking care of ourselves, and I don't know how people have time to work, actually. It's very impractical. Having a job is very impractical. So, and the most important thing is that, and then you have to do all this with a sense of ease. I think one of the things that's happening is the more that we know about all the things we need to do to take care of ourselves, the more guilty we can be, and the more harassed we can be about how we're not doing the things that we need to do. So we actually have to think about our lives and think about how to have some sense of spaciousness and just do something that we're doing and just do our best and know that, you know, it's always going to be incomplete. You're never going to get it all done, and you're always going to be falling down in one or another areas of your life. This is me, you know, I'm thinking to myself, okay, now where am I failing today most? So I need to put a little attention to that area of my life, because that is falling away out of my grasp. So we do our best. And this is a question that also came up in the group. How do we reconcile the Buddhist idea that everyone has the good Buddha within them with the psychological principle that each person should have good boundaries? And we talked about that already a little bit, but I would only add that the good Buddha within somebody could possibly be buried so far within them under such a torrent of, you know, bad experience that maybe we better just silently smile to that Buddha and go somewhere else. Could you please reflect on the distinction between mindfulness and awareness? Well, I guess I was using the two words interchangeably as synonyms, as is, I think is typical in English. There are there's actually a very rich and complicated vocabulary in Asian languages to talk about all of these things, meditation and cultivating the heart and the mind. And that's a whole study in itself, because to understand the vocabulary and the nuances of the different words and the different English versions of the words, it's a very complicated thing, and translation is always inexact. But just to note that there's two words that are translated as mindfulness or awareness. One word is smriti, which a Sanskrit word smriti, which I'm probably pronouncing it poorly, but something like that, which implies to remember, because you forget to be. Mindfulness means remembering to come back, right? And so this acknowledges the fact that the mind does glance off. This is natural. And so awareness is the process of remembering to come back, just like we do in meditation, noticing the mind is not present with the body and the breath, and remembering, oh, I'm meditating, I'm going to come back. The other word is sati, which doesn't include that flavor of that nuance of remembering, and is more like a kind of pure awareness. But there are many other words in Sanskrit and Pali that indicate consciousness, remembrance, awareness, and so on. When we breathe, is it in through nose and out through nose, or in through nose and out the mouth? Well, I may have confused you in the beginning when I suggested a few breaths in the beginning where you breathe in through the nostrils and out through the mouth, pressing on the belly. And that's just a preliminary thing to increase your awareness of the breath. But after that, it's just breathing normally in and out the nostrils. This is first of a series of things about the breath. My teacher in Ashtanga Yoga, my teachers talk about following the breath up from the perineum and watching where it catches, if at all, at the chakras. But recently a yoga class teacher talked about following the inhale down and, in quotes, watering the exhale flow up and out through the crown of the head. What do you think? Well, I think that in yoga often there's more detail about sort of the science of the breath than there is typically in Buddhist meditation, where we're not concerned so much with the science of the breath and the health and various spiritual dimensions of the breath as much as we are simply with the breath as a device for paying attention and being aware. So I pay attention to the breath in the belly, in and out in the belly. But I think that techniques like this that you might learn in yoga or other techniques with the breath can be very valuable to refresh your awareness. So sometimes I use other techniques, but you don't want to make it complicated, you know, and give yourself a to-do list while you're meditating. So I think the basic thing of breathing in and out through the nostrils is good. And this is another one. Someone who experienced fear on following the exhalation all the way out. Since then, since I experienced that, I've meditated on the exhale and have experienced quite joyful moments of complete release and space. But often I exhale. When I exhale, there's a small pause and almost a release of a latch. And then another small release of exhale, a further exhale, it sounds like. I can't tell if there's any inhale before the release. What do you think of that? Well, this is a very, obviously, someone who's very subtly watching the breath, you know, and it just goes to show you how much you can find in the breath when you pay attention to it, and how much that is deep-seated in our living can be expressed in these very subtle ways with the breath that you might not notice unless you pay attention. And the interesting thing is that somehow if you, first of all, the best way to work with that is just keep paying attention without having any standards or anything that's supposed to be, but just watching what it is. And it changes when you watch what it is. But the interesting thing is that sometimes whatever that dark and unknown piece of our lives is that manifests in these little funny things in the breath can be changed by changing the breath. In other words, it goes both ways. So sometimes you work with the breath and you change the breath and things in your life change without your even knowing what they are. So that's interesting to note. And this is another one on a similar vein. Breathing in feels energizing and calming, but I have more trouble breathing out. Sometimes I start feeling in the out-breath, a slight sense of panic. Why do you think that is? So again, probably there's a slight sense of panic in living. I mean, I think that this is actually pretty common, that we feel some underlying constant sense of fear or panic, and then you begin to notice the breath, and you begin to see it in the breath. And again, just be intimate with it. It's not to be fixed. Probably a lot behind it. Be intimate with it. Trust it. Don't worry about it. But study it. Be gentle with it. And with just with the gentle regard, it does begin to change. And then probably other things begin to change too. I'm experiencing a lot of physical difficulties, lower back pain, so on and so forth. But the one that I want to note here is loud noises in my stomach. Very embarrassing, this person says. So if you're in a meditation hall and you have loud noises in your stomach, I think, you know, don't be embarrassed. I think we all have stomachs and digestion. The etiquette of most meditation halls is that the time when you should leave the meditation hall is when you start coughing uncontrollably and you know you're going to cough for the next 10 minutes, then it's probably a good idea to get up and walk out just for the benefit of others in the hall. But all other things like digestion and so forth, you don't need to really, I mean, I think we're all in this together and we're all the same, so probably don't need to worry so much. And to be willing to be your human animal self among others and not feel so embarrassed about it is something that we all should work toward. Sitting meditation and chronic pain. Yeah, so as many of you I'm sure know, Jon Kabat-Zinn is a wonderful, you know, he's such a wonderful person, and what he did is so incredible. As a meditator himself, he did this daring thing of saying, I wonder if meditation could help people in chronic pain. Very courageous things. I'm going to see if I can do some good there. And so he developed a whole methodology of helping people in chronic pain. This means pain that you can't do anything about. Obviously, if you have pain and you can do something about it, you ought to do that, although you ought to pay attention to, you know, sometimes the things we do about our chronic pain end up being more harmful than the initial pay, so one has to pay attention to that. But there are many times when there's pain that cannot be addressed. So meditation is incredibly helpful. And basically what it comes down to is being present with the pain. It's a little bit like what I was saying the other day in the instructions. Breathing into the pain, noticing the tensing and the resistance, trying to relax around the tensing and resistance, and just being with the sensation of pain is really the best thing that you can do. And sometimes the pain will actually go away if you do that. And sometimes if it doesn't go away, it reduces and it's much more manageable. And his great book about this, which is really a classic book, is called Full Catastrophe Living. And you can read that book. You can access the, whatever the name of his center is at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center. They have all kinds of tapes and stuff. And training programs, and there's a lot of offerings in, they have an 8-week course, I think, in stress reduction meditation, which is very, very sound and really good. Please talk about how to coax invasive thoughts from the mind during quiet meditation, especially repeat invaders. repeat offenders, yeah. So this is a good question, and it's obviously, there's no, just do this and it'll go away. I don't think there's anything like that, but there are various ways things that we can do. The most important thing is to practice patience, which is the most important positive spiritual virtue that there is the practice of forbearance or patience, understanding that we just can't make things go away. We're going to have to learn how to meet our difficulties with some equanimity. But one thing you could do, if you find this to be troublesome, is there's a lot of different techniques. One thing you could do is use a word. You're thinking in words, so, meet fire with fire. Use a word. So when you breathe out, the word quiet. Quiet. Breathe out the word quiet. 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 Every breath, saying silently to yourself. And then when these thoughts arise, they're met by the word quiet. And they'll still be there, but they may be somewhat disarmed. Let me finish, and then Robert has a suggestion. Another way is to label the thoughts. So just notice thoughts of fearful thoughts or worried thoughts or whatever. Label and let go. Another way would be to focus on sounds. Listening. Once you establish posture and breathing, listen to sounds. And another way would be to, every time a thought arises, ask yourself the question, seriously, who is thinking this thought? Who is thinking this? And be with that question in a serious way. That might help. And Robert has something else maybe.
One story is about living in this cave in Tibet, and there were these little demons which you can think of as your thoughts. And they, for some reason, they were shaped like teacup slices. And they would come to the mountain of this cave all the time, and they would taunt them, and they would throw things at them. And it's kind of the same as your thoughts that continue to come in the same direction. And Villarete would say, go away, get out of here. And he would throw things back at them, and they would scatter, and then a few minutes later, they'd come back.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for that story, because that I think that is the most important point, actually, is that the more you resist and want these things to go away, the more they keep coming, which is what that story is about. And when you say, okay, you know, I'll be forbearing, they go away. Probably not instantly, as in the story, but eventually, yeah. Thank you for that. One of my true goals from learning the practice is to accomplish a paradigm shift in the way I seem to filter most interactions with people and circumstances. Everything seems filtered through the lens of judgment and evaluation. Is it good or bad? Usually, good meaning good or bad for me. Is he or she smart or not smart? Am I perceived as smart or not smart? Can I listen, really listen to someone without these judgments and evaluations? I want to very much, and I think with help, I'll get better. And this is a beautiful and important one because we all have this. And I think it's seems to be a particular disease of our time and our culture, that this is so pervasive. Judging ourselves, judging others, and everything. It's so annoying, just like these teacup demons. It's very much the same, you know. It's so annoying to have, when you begin to notice it, when you don't notice it, it's there all the time and you just sort of take it for granted. When you start to notice it, it becomes more and more uncomfortable and unpleasant. Like, why do I need this, you know? Why do I have to, and it just keeps coming and coming. So, it's a very similar case that we just said a moment ago. One has to be patient. One can use the techniques I just listed. Who is judging? In meditation practice, who is it who's judging? Who is it who's judging? But I think to notice, focus on this resistance, on our resistance to it, and try to let go of the resistance, because the resistance definitely makes it persist. So I'm judging, and I'm judging myself for judging. And I'm judging myself for judging that I'm judging, you know, and it goes on like that. So I think one has to study that resistance and really try to let go at the point of resistance and be patient. And it does make a difference, little by little by little. It does change. And this is a terrific thing, you know, to live life without having to all the time evaluate everything and everybody and just say, oh, there's something. Isn't that interesting? I wonder what it is, you know. This is a huge difference in living. And would make it, life is much nicer. So, and definitely the path of meditation and all the things that we've been talking about will help. And the questioner says, I think I'll get better at this. And so that, to me, that's a very important part of the question because that says there's some sense of hope there, some sense of confidence that, yeah, I think I can do that. And you can. And the last one, this person says, this actually is not a question, this person found comments about meditating with pain, like I was, you know, instructing the other day, really helpful. This is one of the main tools I will take away that will allow me to embark on this practice. And I didn't feel that I could say this without getting overly emotional, which is a very sweet thing. So I guess this was important for this person. And it is true that feeling like we have a way of working with our difficulties other than wishing that they would go away or searching fruitlessly for a magic technique that will make them go away. This is the most important thing, to have a spirit of, I know that there will be difficulties and I will breathe with them, I'll work with them, I'll study my resistance to the difficulty. And little by little, I'll let go of the resistance. And when I'm willing to be with, it's the, again, the paradox. When I'm willing to be with the difficulty and not resist it, it's no longer a difficulty. You see? And so that's why when you're sitting and these little difficulties arise, whether it's the judging mind, the persistent thoughts, a pain that arises, this is great because then you can, it's a laboratory, it's a microscope. You can study the mind resisting and fighting. And the more, even just one moment of not doing that is huge. And then another moment, and then another moment. And if you can begin to develop that on your cushion, you can begin to develop that in your life. And so when you're confronted with a massive problem coming at you from another person in the world, in your work, you can have the attitude of, okay, I don't need to resist, I don't need to fight, I don't need to fend off, I need to face this. If I face this, I'll find a way. And that's really important and really great. Changes everything. So, that's, I think I got all the notes that were, it's all the notes that I got this week. Thank you for your notes. They were fun. Gave me something to think about while I was getting bored with all this meditation. I think we have maybe 5 minutes or so for any further questions about the meditation practice, if anybody has anything. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So important in my life, something I've only gotten to in recent years, is forgiving myself, putting the past in the past,
yeah,
and realizing I can start anew.
Yeah.
Every day.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Start over again. Yeah, Frank. Yeah.
And so what I learned this weekend is without questions, without process,
yeah, that's it. Yeah, and exactly. Thanks. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That if I was judging somebody, then I was judgmental and I was bad.
Yeah.
And that, like you said, like who is being judgmental?
Yeah.
Who is doing that? And to fully accept that is not my core.
Right.
You know, that's something that is, I don't want to say separate, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not
me. Yeah, right. It's thoughts coming and going.
Yeah.
And thoughts come and go for reasons. It's not your fault. You didn't decide. I think I'd like to have a whole bunch of negative thoughts right now. That's what I want. You didn't say that. So it's not your fault. It arises because of causes and conditions. Make something arise. Yeah. Adela? Yeah.
Hi. Oh, the mind wandering. I notice besides fear, which I can breathe out and out of practice this morning, and there are problems that go on, the things my mind wanders on. A lot of those demons, those saucer-sized demons, are things that are none of my problems. And last weekend I had a party and two people met and they had a date last night. And I've been thinking about this. This has been the focus of my meditation for the past 3 days. No, I mean, my business. But anyway, so I think I can eliminate 3/4 of the thoughts that wander through if I edit the ones.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And there's no such thing as a good or a bad meditator either. Right. There's just doing it. Yeah. Oh.
I have a technique that I used this weekend for the first. This is my first time meditating, but for dealing with the demons. Well, they weren't demons. They were work and things that were, you know, like what's happening. But I.
Demons.
I see things. I'm a very visual person. Mm-hmm. So I actually visualized the dresser in that room, and I said the bottom drawer.
Put them in the bottom
drawer. It would come up, and I'd say, "Oh, you're for the bottom drawer," and I'd see myself opening it, and I said, "I know that this is visualization. It's like a dream. It's not real, but it worked." And every time something would come in, I'd grab it. You're the bottom drawer.
Yeah.
I said, I'll see you later.
Yeah.
I'll see you later. I'll pull it up and I'll deal with all of it.
Yeah.
But just go there now.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, wham.
Yeah. Gone. Yeah. Well, that's great, you know, because that shows, you know, that in a way, once you get into it, the meditation practice can be very creative in this way. The tradition, the meditation traditions have such wonderful imaginative, like that Tibetan story is such a precious story. The traditions have these wonderful stories and illustrations. And you can imagine that was a meditation technique, that somebody would sit there and visualize their thoughts as saucers and so on. And after all, where did that come from? A very imaginative person practicing meditation invented that. And so we can be free ourselves to invent such things. And once we understand the basic practice and what we're trying to do and where we're trying to go with it, we can do stuff like that and become very helpful. So that may be your unique practice, and maybe several other people here now can do that practice, and we can find things for ourselves. And so it becomes a very creative and interesting process to working with our own mind. This is the thing. Whoever taught us how to work with our own mind and work with our own heart and take that on as something that we need to be doing rather than just assume a given and then be focused externally. No, work with our own mind. It's very important. And we all find our own ways to do that, what works for us, our own techniques, and it's a wonderful creative endeavor. What a great way to spend a life. So I got to go, and we have to get on with our closing. There's a whole bunch of things that we want to tell you about and give you, and then we want to give everybody a chance to speak closing words. But these are my closing words, so because I got to go and get in this very expensive car and have the gentleman tuck me in and close the door. Yes, Charlie. Thank you. It's my pleasure. I really had fun. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Yeah. There's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Dharma talks on there. You could listen to my voice for the rest of your life, practically. They tell me that it's much more effective than sleeping pills. If you listen to it at night, it's very soothing. You can fall asleep, you know, with a good thought in your mind. So, anyway, please visit the site. It's got my schedule on there if you ever want to sit a retreat. And it does have really a lot of material, written material, and downloadable material. And every day zen.org, yeah. And it even has it has a Google search engine on the site, so that if you type in, probably if you type in lawyers, or maybe if you type in lawyers retreat at Menla, it'll send you all around the site to where you, because there's so much stuff on there. So, yeah, I always leave a retreat thinking to myself, I know that I'm going to see these people again somewhere. I feel confident of that. So when I do see you again, and I look at you and I say, we've practiced together, I know. I know you really well. Where? And then you'll tell me where. So I hope that I will see you at a retreat, at an event, at a talk, somewhere. And I really feel like each person that takes up this practice is like 500 people. Because every person that you, when you really start doing this and make it a part of your life, every person that comes into contact with you is going to be influenced by this, one way or the other. So each one of us is like 500 people. And this is how we're going to have a different world, in a different profession, person by person by person. It's going to happen. I have full confidence in that. Thanks very much. Really, it's been a tremendous pleasure. Take care.